From KQED Public Radio, this is Capital Notes, our weekly look at all things in California politics. I'm John Myers from KQED and the California Report, and Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly, sitting here across from me in our studios, looking a little grizzled this morning. You look like I feel.
Great. That bad, huh?
Wow. That's a heck of a compliment to start off a podcast, isn't it?
Good. Well, you know, it's a new era.
Oh, man. It's been a long week. It's been a long election night. And then we're back here at the Capitol for other stuff. So you're going to get this podcast on Thursday. I should say this probably almost every podcast, but podcasts have a shelf life. This one will have a shelf life because returns that we talk about, votes that are being still counted, who knows? If you listen to this on Monday, don't get mad if we say something was X and it turns out to be Y because these things are fluid.
You sound like Joe Biden. Don't get mad if things go wrong. It's not our fault.
There'll be a crisis. I will be tested. Anthony will be tested. So, yes, we're going to bring this podcast to you early. And then next week, we'll go back to all the pain and suffering of the state budget. Even though there's a little news about that this week, we want to talk about elections and kind of examine what happened on Election Day across the state. So let's talk, I guess, first. Well, first of all, we got to talk about the presidential race. A thumping. What do we call that for Obama beating McCain in California?
I think shellacking and thumping are good. You know, was it 61-37? Was that the final tally?
According to current results.
Spanking? Can we add spanking in there?
I mean, clearly the biggest defeat or biggest victory, you know, in modern times in California for a presidential race. And we were talking right before we started recording the podcast. I want to give him some credit because he predicted it would be right. Tony Quinn, who's a longtime analyst of state politics and works on the Target Book, which looks at legislative races with Alan Hoffenblum. Quinn penned a column that said he thought that the model for the Obama-McCain results would be the Dianne Feinstein-Dick Mountjoy U.S. Senate race in 2006. He said he thought it would be just as big of a gap, and he was almost spot on. I think we looked before we came in here, that race ended at almost Feinstein with 60% and Mountjoy with 35, almost exactly this. I mean, really, really a repudiation of the Republican candidate.
Yeah, and we saw that reflected in the final polls before the election. Both the PPIC and the field poll had similarly audacious margins for Barack Obama. And that was never a question. The question was how that was going to translate and impact both the ballot measures and the legislative results. And, you know, Democrats were giddy in the run-up to the election about the prospects of picking up some legislative seats. And, you know, I think you can make the argument that it didn't pan out as well as they had planned.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, if we sit here and look at it broadly for a moment, I have a hard time seeing the Obama tidal wave that we talked about and that others talked about. Right. It's not to say there wasn't an influence, but I'm not sure, right? I'm not sure Democrats got anywhere near out of it what they thought they might when they were as euphoric as they were over Obama winning the state.
Right, compared to the expectations. Now, I mean, the Democrats did pick up three seats in the assembly that had been held by Republicans, and they lost one that was held by a Democrat that was a Republican pickup. It's a net gain of two seats. And, you know, those aren't the numbers they were talking about even on Election Day. They were talking about picking up three, four, even five or six seats.
Well, and let's come back to the legislature in a moment. But talking about the impact, let's look at the statewide ballot measures. Mm-hmm. The numbers are still coming in. I think we can safely say which ones won and lost, with the exception of one that I would put an asterisk by. You tell me, Anthony, I was somewhat surprised by a few of them because, and I'll give you an example, the borrowing proposals,
yep.
I thought would have a much tougher night than they did,
right?
Because the public has heard so much about how much the state is in debt. Prop 1A, the high-speed rail bond, passed. Prop 3, the children's hospital bond, passed. Prop 12, the veterans loans bond, passed.
Right. Although that one gets paid back.
That one gets paid back, but, I mean, it's still a bond nonetheless. Right. But 1A and 3 are much more traditional bonding, borrowing by the state.
Right.
Hundreds of millions of dollars the state will be on the hook once those bonds are sold. And it seemed at one point that they were kind of behind, although it's kind of hard to tell what part of the state is reporting its returns on election night. But long and short of it is the appetite for the public for bonds does not seem to be diminished.
Right. Well, they look good. They have, you know, who doesn't like high-speed rail and children's hospitals? I mean, they sound good. And these are the kinds of tough spending decisions that we're expecting our legislators to make. You know, these are the cuts that are going to be made in the next few weeks and months here are over popular programs. I mean, depending on how you want to make the case, I mean, there were other proposals that cost money, including the two sort of green initiatives that would spend money on renewable energy.
Prop 7 and Prop 10.
Right, the solar, big solar and big wind, as they were known.
Well, and 10 was a borrowing measure, too. I mean, it would have been bonding for rebates for clean vehicles.
Right, and it was defeated. Of course, it was opposed by many of the major environmental groups. And, and then some of the law and order stuff. Prop 5, which would have spent a lot of money on nonviolent drug offenses. Yeah, I mean, those aren't just straight borrowing proposals. There are other ideological considerations about why those failed. But your point is
And that's
is well
an interesting
taken.
Point because, I mean, it is very hard to figure out why the voters voted the way they did on some things. Let's talk 9. Well, let's talk about Prop 6. Let's talk about Prop 6 and 9, but let's talk about Prop 6. Prop 6 was this proposal, as you might remember, if you read your voter guide, to go after some gang crimes that happened in California, to crack down more, to make jail sentences a little more firm that you had to go. And also, but of course, that came at a cost. Now, the author of Prop 6, George Runner, state senator from Southern California, in a statement he released after the vote said, well, it wasn't that they didn't favor my get tough on crime. They just thought the price tag was too high.
Well, what's
and
the
maybe,
difference?
Maybe, but the price tag for other things did not deter the voters. I mean, price tags were talked about in a lot of these campaigns.
Right. And the state voters were schizophrenic. I think one of the big surprises on election night was the passage of Proposition 9, the Victims' Rights Initiative, which will extend parole terms that you can now only come up for parole. It's an amendment to the Constitution, changing the length of parole so you can now come up for parole once every 15 years instead of 5. It allows victims' families to testify. As many members of the family that want to testify at a sentencing hearing will be allowed to testify. It's another one of those things that the ballot description, I mean, who's against victims' rights? Objectively, when you read it, if you're reading it for the first time and all you're reading is the description, the ballot description, which I think is honestly how many people do cast their vote, especially on campaigns like this where there isn't a lot of publicity, there isn't a lot of focus, there isn't a lot of attention, that those things can slip past. Once again, the California voters, I think, continue to send us mixed messages. And some of those mixed messages, I think, are reflected in the actions and the divisions of the legislature.
Yeah, and I've long thought that as well, that people talk about the legislature being dysfunctional, but it does seem to mirror...
It's an accurate reflection.
Yeah, it does seem to mirror the dysfunction that we all have as Californians.
Yes. Yes.
So let's talk about the big three ballot measures for a moment that got the most attention and kind of were some of the most contentious. Of those three, and I'll list what they are, Proposition 2 about farm animals and confinement of farm animals, pretty accurate to the polls. It just completely swamped the no side, and so it was a pretty strong win for that measure. And we've even seen now some more data coming out after the election suggesting that perhaps the price of eggs will not go up as much as the no side had said they were.
This isn't going to go into effect until 2015, right?
But so. even in the Central Valley, even in big ag areas, Prop 2 did very well.
Right.
It was not the traditional split of liberal conservative coastal inland as much. I mean, there were still good returns even in Fresno.
Well, for
Prop 2.
And most of this affects the ag industry. The ag industry is by and large not located within California. It's located in other states. And my understanding of many of the California egg farmers, they already abide by many of these standards that are in Prop 2. So that may have been some of the reason why people in the Central Valley, were okay voting for it.
And Proposition 4, I'm kind of going saving the most contentious, biggest race for last here for a moment. But Proposition 4, which was the parental notification for a teenager who would want to have an abortion, I thought was going to be closer.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a resounding no vote, I would say. And then this has been on the ballot three times now in California.
Right.
They've made some modifications to the initiative this time versus the first time it was on the ballot.
Right.
But it's still the same issue. You wonder at what point the proponents of this change of parental notification, what point do they take no for an answer?
That's a good question. I don't know. My sense of the campaign, I haven't looked at the spending on the campaign, but just from picking up the media, the media doesn't sound like there was a lot of money spent on this campaign this time around.
Well, there was certainly more spent on the no side, right?
Right. But if it doesn't cost that much to run the yes campaign, why not keep trying? And I think that gets to a larger issue about access to the ballot for some of these initiatives and maybe some reform of the initiative process, that some of these groups and individuals who are concerned with structural reform of state government, I think, are going to be looking at.
Well, and reform of the initiative process, I think, is going to be a discussion in the final big race, which was Proposition 8, which was the ban on same-sex marriages, which passed.
We're not talking 11?
Oh, we'll get to 11, but okay. 11
for a different reason. I thought we were going in reason. Order of contention. No,
no. I'm skipping
ahead.
All around the ballot.
Okay. We're going in numerical order.
This is called fielder's choice.
Okay.
But Proposition 8, clearly the most high-profile measure, national attention, probably worldwide attention, constitutional ban on same-sex marriages passed.
Yeah.
Passed, and as we have seen in the hours immediately afterward, the no side has already filed their case in the state Supreme Court, arguing, and this is why I talk about the initiative process, arguing the procedure for doing this to the Constitution, not what's in the Constitution as much as the procedure, arguing that this is not an amendment to the state Constitution. It is a revision of the state Constitution because the court had already given them the rights. You're revising a right that's already in there. You can't do that by the straight initiative process. You have to go through the legislature for the legislature to place such a measure on the ballot. That's a long way of saying a couple of things. Well, first of all, let's talk about the government reform part, I mean, which is not really what people are focusing on. They're focusing on the impact in people's lives. But the government reform part says, again, this is one of the challenges of making so many laws by initiative. Are we doing it the way that it should be set up? Do we have ways to deal with the ramifications? What do we do with the couples who are already married, who are stuck in a legal limbo here between not being married and married?
And how can you justify having some gay couples who are allowed to marry and then others now who will not be able to?
I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah, there's an equal protection issue there. And it seems like very quickly you get at some issues about that may end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, just looking at this, there are some federal constitutional issues here. One of the things that the no side, and I think, I don't think I'm alone in believing that part of the reason this initiative passed was simply the tactical decisions that the two campaigns made. The Yes campaign ran an excellent campaign in terms of changing the focus away from gay marriage onto education, kids, and schools. They really were successful at framing the debate. The no side was a mess.
And I don't know who you've talked to. I mean, I've picked up on talking to some sources. There was a shakeup in the no campaign a few weeks ago, which a lot of political reporters really weren't dialed in to see. There was a shakeup in who was consulting, who was brought in because of those very issues. There was this sense that the no campaign had totally gone off course in what they needed to do to knock Prop 8 down.
And that they got complacent by some of these early poll numbers, which showed it losing pretty handily. And then, the debate changed. There was an incident in San Francisco where a class was taken to witness a lesbian wedding, and this fed in to this narrative on the Yes side. Certainly, the Yes side used Gavin Newsom as a poster boy for everything that is wrong, and we can talk maybe another podcast about what this who the winners and losers are going forward out of this election. And there were just divisions on the no side. The messaging was muddled. I mean, there were, different ads, different messages. Now there's a lot of hand-wringing and bloodletting. I mean, it's McCain versus Palin times 10. I mean, it's nasty.
Well, and I was going to say, I mean, this is, for people who are political junkies or just watchers of the political process, this is a textbook case of messaging and political strategy and political campaigns. The Yes side was playing offense the entire campaign. The No side was playing defense the entire campaign. When you are having to respond to the other side's accusations and criticisms the entire campaign, you're going to have a very difficult time getting at your message. I mean, if you think back, and I was trying to think about this the other day, see if my recollection matches yours, Anthony, that if you roll back the calendar, it seemed like the Yes side got going late. There was a gap there where the no side was a little more organized. Their money was a little more in place. You remember the yes side didn't have their campaign signs. Right. They got delayed. They didn't get up on the air first, I don't think. I mean, it was a slower start. But once the eight side hit, once the yes side hit the no side with the school accusation, it was all offense from there.
Right.
It was, and the no side, all they did was try to rebut the idea of the schools. There was no other campaign at that point.
Yeah, and you know, Frank Schubert and Jeff Flint, who ran the strategists for the Yes side, deserve a lot of credit for the passage of Prop 8.
Mm-hmm. And I think they probably realized that if they had to have just a debate about the relationships between gay Californians, they were not going to win that debate.
Yeah.
They had to find some other issue to bring to the voters' attention.
The interesting thing is that, you know, for the opponents of Prop 8 is the amount of work that the gay community has to do in the African-American community in terms of making their case.
Yeah, there was some strong exit polling showing a real yes support on the African-American
side. Yeah, you know, there was a lot of talk about possibly Latinos being more culturally conservative. One exit poll, and, you know, take it with a grain of salt, it's an exit poll. It's just as flawed and imperfect as any other poll. But the exit poll I saw, I believe, was a CNN exit poll, showed that support in the Latino community was about mixed. It was about 53-47 in favor of Prop 8. But in the African-American community, it was overwhelming. It was 70-30 in favor. Now, you know, estimated turnout, African-American turnout in California was about 1 million black voters. 70-30, that's a 400,000 vote spread right there. That's the margin. That's mm-hmm. the margin of victory for Prop 8, apparently. So I think that going forward, and look, this thing's coming back, whether it comes back in the courts, in the legislature, on the ballot, in some combination. I think that the gay community and proponents of gay marriage have some work to do in the black community.
Well, I think it's difficult to see it coming back to the Capitol. I know yesterday in a press conference about budget issues, Daryl Steinberg, the incoming pro tem of the state Senate, was asked about this notion of trying to move forward the process through this notion of a revision of the Constitution. And he said, you know, he was very open to that and would do it and all the things that, you know, he would say in support. But it takes a 2/3 vote of the legislature to place a measure on the ballot.
You
and the
think
governor
that's
has
happen?
To. Yeah. And the governor has to concur, too. And, right. and you know, and I and even if you got through legislative Republicans, which is an impossible hurdle, I think the governor thinks the voters have spoken. I think the governor almost said that in a different campaign event on Wednesday anyway. Right. So. That one's a tough one. Let's talk about one more ballot measure quickly, which is Prop 11. Saved it for last. And it's the asterisk mark, I would say, because it's ahead as though it is winning. But the margin is pretty darn thin. Anthony's got the latest numbers we printed out before we came in, but it was about 100,000 votes.
Right. That's about the number I'm seeing here.
Out of about 9 million cast. And so and there are a lot of uncounted ballots still out there. So Prop 11 may not pass. Prop 11... if you don't know what it is by name, then you probably aren't listening to our podcast. But it's a redistricting reform, a new independent commission to draw political maps. And, you know, I think the moral of that story probably is there was not a no campaign.
Right.
But one fascinating factoid, I've done this in a few other elections, add up the total number of votes cast for different ballot measures, and you can start to get a pattern of what a voter does when they go into the booth and they go, I don't know what to do with this, and they don't vote on it.
Right.
Prop 8... and we don't have official returns now, but Prop 8 and the presidential race both garnered somewhere around 10 million, a little more than 10 million votes as of the votes counted as of Thursday. Prop 11 only garnered about 9 million votes. It was actually the lowest when I was counting yesterday, Wednesday. It was actually the lowest of all 12 ballot measures in total number of votes. Hmm. So clearly it was the one where people, you know, there were a fair number of people who went, I don't know, I'm not going to vote. And, you know, and that's the confusion of the voter again. But a lack of a no campaign plus people maybe angry about government plus the governor equals maybe a win.
Possibly. And more important, this is going to settle. I believe that Prop 11 is the tiebreaker in the Myers versus York predictions.
Our predictions. So do we do predictions now since we're going to talk about the legislature?
Well, we can.
Okay. So here are our predictions. Here were our predictions last week. Now let's just do it because then that'll get us to the legislature and then we should probably go do some other work instead of ramble on politics. So on Prop 8, Anthony and I both said it was going to be close. Well, I actually thought it was going to be closer than it was.
So did I, but I thought it would go the other way.
Yeah. So Anthony and I both said the no side would end up prevailing in a close race. We were both wrong. So... an X for both of us there.
Right. Chalk that up to blinders of the liberal media elite.
On Prop 11, Anthony said it would pass. Mm-hmm. I said it would fail. Anthony currently is winning that one.
Right. We'll
but see. I could come back. So when the votes are counted,
you're still in play there.
And then we had two others. And then we asked about, then we said, what's the total number of Democratic seats in the assembly going to be? And Anthony, and I said 52, which would have been pick up of four. Anthony said 51.
51.
Pick up of three. And it looks like it's 50.
Right.
In which case,
do
neither
I get partial credit?
No. Because you're one closer?
I'm closer. Price is right rules, man. I would win. I get
podcast rules.
No.
So we're both wrong on that one. And we'll talk about the legislature. And then we talked about the state Senate race. In Ventura County, Hannabeth Jackson, Democrat, Tony Strickland, the Republican. York said Jackson, Myers said Strickland. Currently,
108 votes.
108 votes, Jackson winning, so York would win.
Out of about 300,000 cast. I'm not ready to declare victory yet on that one.
I don't think you should, because there are a lot of votes to be counted.
Yeah.
So if I look at my scorecard, it appears that this really hinges on uncounted ballots on Prop 11 and the state Senate race, as to who's the king of podcast predictions.
Oh, and since you're not giving me credit for being closer.
No.
And I believe I called Assembly District 10 specifically, that it would be too much to overcome.
No.
The one I was wrong was the hold on the 30th district.
Okay, well, let's talk about the assembly briefly here. Okay, so I think it's safe to say that going into the election, Democrats said, well, we'll at least get 50.
Right.
We'll at least be at 50 in the legislature, you know, a pickup of two in the assembly, a pickup of two seats. But we think we can get better than that.
Right.
No one was predicting 54, really. I mean,
Torres was.
Well, the chairman of the Democratic Party was, you know, a bit too optimistic. But no one who you really talked to thought they'd get to 54. Yeah. Though some people said it's possible if the Obama sensation is that strong.
If he had won by 63 points.
Right. And it was pretty strong.
Yeah, it doesn't get much stronger.
It doesn't get much stronger than he won in California. But suffice it to say, they got the bare minimum they thought they would get. And I do think that some people will consider that to be a lackluster performance for Democrats on the local level because, you know, in a big Democratic year, why didn't you get more? And these are local issues is what we say.
Right. Well, we get a lot of ticket splitters in California. California voters are still like that. But right. I mean, the Republicans tried very hard to localize all of these issues. Look, some of the registration numbers are daunting. We've talked before about Prop 11. If there was no gerrymander, if Prop 11 had been in place after the 2000 census, this would have been a much different election. I think you would have seen some of these closer seats tip to Democrats. But this is the way it was supposed to look when the gerrymander was designed.
Right.
These 50 seats. Exactly these seats.
Yeah.
Because
I was
going to
say, they picked up the seats that they didn't hold before,
right.
that they always thought they would get. The 78th near San Diego, the 80th near Palm Springs, and the 15th in the
San Ramon, Bay,
Central Valley, up to Sacramento area.
And they lost the 30th, which was the Hanford.
Fresno, that area.
Right, that one's tough. So, but, you know, all these other pickups, the races like the 10th in the Sacramento down to Lodi area, and where else were they? In the...
26th?
Right. Bill Berryhill versus John Eisenhut in the Central Valley. And they played on the coast, too. The Audra Strickland versus Farrell Masri in the Ventura, Santa Barbara area. Those were races where the registration was just too tough for Democrats to overcome, even in a year like this. And I think it sort of begs the larger question about the Obama mandate and the Democratic mandate nationally. It's sort of a similar situation. Democrats picked up some Senate seats nationally, but they didn't get to 60, right? There wasn't the big pickup, apparently, on the federal level. And I think that in many ways what happened here in California is a microcosm of that.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing we were noticing about the data before we sat down to do the podcast is low voter turnout in some of these assembly districts. I mean, one in particular, the 30th, it appears, down in the Hanford, Bakersfield-ish area.
Of the competitive ones, right?
Yeah, and vis-a-vis how much was spent on that race.
Right.
I mean, you know, the final numbers, when we do dollar per vote, it really does beg the question about some of the money spent in politics these days for what feels like voter apathy in some cases.
Well, I think the 80th, too, out in Imperial Riverside County is where it looks like Manuel Perez, the Democrat, will emerge and take that seat back, the seat that was held by Bonnie Garcia. I haven't seen how many – I don't have those numbers in front of me about how many turned out, but that's another one.
Yeah.
Low voter turnout and the amount of money per vote is just astonishing.
And we mentioned the state Senate race, but I want to circle back to it as we end here, the Hannabeth Jackson-Tony Strickland race. just as competitive as it possibly could have been, the most expensive legislative race in California this year, the most expensive elected office race, because, of course, you know, we didn't have any on a statewide level.
Right.
A lot of money spent on both sides, an ugly campaign on a lot of sides, a lot of accusations, and what, 100 and how many votes?
108 as of the last count.
108 as of Thursday morning here. And you got to think we're going to get just a whole phalanx of election experts being, descending on that area like we've had in the past, right? From both parties to watch the counting of provisionals and anything remaining.
Everyone come home from Ohio and Missouri and Florida. It's time to go to Ventura.
That would give the Democrats 26 seats in the Senate, one short of that magical two-thirds majority. And if it holds and Hannabeth Jackson goes to the Senate, imagine the intensity of the man who holds all the cards now, which is Abel Maldonado, the state senator from the Central Coast, a Republican, who voted with the Democrats at one point last year on a budget deal, who's seen as a little bit more moderate.
And who's now a lame duck. Remember, he was just reelected to his final term.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to run for reelection.
Can't run for reelection in that state Senate seat. That's a fascinating dynamic as we deal with these financial problems we're going to be dealing with over the next few weeks.
Well, remember, all these senators now who were just reelected, half the Senate was reelected this week. These senators now have run their last race in these districts. Even if they're new senators, these districts are going to be different in 4 years.
Yeah. The maps redrawn will be by redrawn. Someone.
So, and whether that changes the dynamic and how it does, I don't know. But should be interesting. I think, we'll talk next week about the budget and all things budget and how ugly that's going to be. But I think that, this new blood, that it's going to change the dynamic a little bit.
Yeah. So there are a few things we'll have to keep watching on this election. We'll have to watch the legal challenges on Prop 8. We'll have to see whether Prop 11 passes. And maybe we'll go back
Senate race.
Yeah, count some ballots and count some dollars as to the rest of it as we come back. And, of course, next week, as you said, budget.
Budget.
Back to the same old Groundhog Day story we always do on the podcast.
So everybody can go back to sleep.
Yes, right. Take a nap. Come back and visit us at the end of next week.
And vote for those new bonds, whatever they are. Right?
There you go.
That's right.
Vote early.
Deeper hole, more spending. Why not?
And with that, we'll end the podcast. I'm John Myers from KQED. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly. We'll see you next time.